Century is Mecca for communication and for the visual. Smartphones, video conferencing, internet telephony, YouTube, it's on for young and old. And today on the show, we're locating interesting signals in all that noise. Because if sign language is the main way you converse, then as a master of the visual, this is your century.
They see the world through different eyes. We just had an international film festival here on campus, and the films were made by deaf filmmakers, and the parallel between the devices in the natural sign language, the grammatical and meaning-making devices within the visual spatial language, and film production is striking. Deaf filmmakers know they have a great deal to offer too. So I think we've just really begun to understand that we've got a lot to offer the rest of the world in partnership to advance knowledge that we all need. The 21st century, the media, the ability to work in visual media now, what the internet is offering, it has opened up a whole world of possibilities for that.
They were the first to use video as a means of mass communication before hearing people. They were the first to use pagers. They're first to text. And in fact, there is more email and texting going on per capita on the Gallaudet campus than on places in Manhattan. So deaf people are early adopters. They are out in front. And this is very much counter to a common way of looking at them as being, as needing remediation.
Professor Dirksen-Bauman and Professor Carol Erting, both at Gallaudet University. And getting technological today, hearing aids, mobile phones, cochlear implants, and more. Welcome to All in the Mind. Natasha Mitchell on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Washington DC, as we have over the past two shows, and you can catch those online. This is the world's first and only university for deaf students, and we're digging up stories that might redefine how we all live in the world, deaf and hearing. I'm in the office with the provost of Gallaudet University, and we're looking out over the campus. It's a cold day, no snow, it's quite crisp and sunny.
Actually, I love looking out my window here in my office because I don't only see the campus. I see the Gallaudet campus juxtaposed on the Capitol of the United States. I see the Capitol Dome. I see the Washington Monument. And every day I'm reminded of how much impact we have on the world just by looking at this panorama. And it just gives me more reason to continue the work that I do and to preserve Gallaudet for future generations.
It's quite great that your office is in direct line with Congress, just over the horizon.
And every time I see the light coming on in Congress, I know Congress is in session, and it reminds me how amazing this experiment has been for the last 150 years. Oh, and Congress, by the way, is also an experiment in and of itself. And so we're two parallel experiments going on within blocks of one another.
If only they recognize that.
Agreed.
Professor Steve Weiner there, speaking through American Sign Language interpreters Paul Harrelson and Adam Bartley. Speaking of experiments, we're also covering some provocative findings from science about the genetics of deafness.
Well, it will be the first time that I can think of that deaf researchers have taken upon themselves to research deafness in this way.
But first, to something many take for granted, picking up the phone to ring a friend.
Hello, my name is Norman Williams. I'm a senior research engineer for the Technology Access Program here at Gallaudet University. I'm deaf, and my background is in telecommunications and the development of telecommunications. And I thought I'd just give you a little bit of background on what deaf people use for communication. Way back, AT&T had very large machines, and I think probably in the 1930s, 1940s, and those were called TTYs. Mm. And they were big machines that printed out messages letter by letter. When they were no longer used, the deaf community asked AT&T to donate them. And there was a deaf man who developed a modem, and they were able to put the phone handset on the modem and connect that to the TTY. And for the first time, deaf people were able to communicate over the telephone line, and that was used for many years. And the TTYs became smaller, they became electronic, and then became portable. And they weren't as portable as cell phones that could be put in a pocket, but they were made to be quite portable. They could be transported with.
TTY simply stands for teletypewriter, a device which allows you to type in text to communicate down a telephone line.
Before the TTY technology came online, what sort of barrier did the telephone present to people who were deaf or hearing impaired?
Deaf people would often ask hearing friends or family or perhaps the neighbor to make a telephone call for them. They would walk next door and ask a neighbor, you know, would you please make a telephone call for me? And then if two deaf people wanted to talk to one another, they had to talk through two hearing people in order to make the phone call. And that was the state of deaf communication back then.
In effect, you had to have four people involved in a single telephone call, and no such thing as a private phone call.
That's correct. Now we have Relay, and that was a service to make phone calls between a TTY and a user and a hearing person who was not using a TTY. But that was made available at limited hours. You had limits on the number of minutes per phone call that you could use it, because they would, the TTY or the Relay Center would receive many calls every day, so they had to place limits on the service. And also it was made through volunteers, through volunteer operators. Then Congress passed a law to set up Relay or mandate the establishment of Relay services all across the 50 states, and the service was provided 24 hours a day. There were no limits on the length of the phone call, and so deaf people would use it for work in order to order pizza, you know, for their private life.
Hi, my name is Paula Tucker, and I'm a research associate in the Technology Access Program at Gallaudet University. I started out my career teaching deaf high school students and middle school students. Later on, I moved to research, and this is something where I can really make a big impact and make positive changes.
Now, the Technology Access Program, at the heart of that title is access. What is the program about?
We are a grant-funded research program where we look at various types of telecommunications technology and how it can be made accessible to deaf and hard of hearing people. Over the years, it's included everything from teletype machines, TTYs, captioning, as telephone technology has changed, early cell phones, texting on phones. We've looked at vibrations for emergency notification. I mean, just about anything that you can think of relating to telecommunications and deaf and hard of hearing users, we've done it. And we've really seen things change. And the whole goal is to level the playing field so that deaf and hard of hearing people have the same access that hearing people do. And although the technology has really improved, and it's just we're light years ahead of where we used to be, sometimes there are barriers out there that don't even really involve the technology. So, for example, video relay service, which allows deaf people and hearing people to talk to each other over the phone through an intermediary.
That intermediary being a human being.
Exactly, through a relay service. The problem is when a deaf person wants to call up a business, for example, who doesn't have experience using a video relay, often when they hear that it's a video relay operator calling them, they'll hang up because they think it's a crank call or some kind of scam. So although the technology is there, there are still human barriers that exist.
Also, I mean, technology can be an enabler, can't it? But it can also be a terrible disabler if it's not optimized for the use of its user.
Right, absolutely. And one of the studies that we're doing now is on telecollaboration. And as it costs more to travel and people work farther away from their colleagues, you see more and more teleconferencing, more video teleconferencing, and various types of software programs that are involved. And as these become more complex, it puts barriers up for people with various disabilities. Mm. Are there fixes? And what can we do to let industry know that as the use of this type of technology increases, we want people with disabilities to be able to use it just as well.
Is industry interested?
They are, but it's a slow process. And
you're considered a small market, I guess.
Yes, although, you know, the disability community is larger than people think. And, you know, as they say, everybody is just one step away. And as we age, the disability community grows. We have more people with hearing loss. We have more people with mobility issues, more people with vision loss. So we don't stop using technology as we age, but we may need different ways to use the technology.
Yes, indeed, because imagine the generation practically born with a mobile phone in their hands, giving it up just because they need a hearing aid at some stage. Well, in fact, mobile phones present all sorts of challenges if you wear a hearing device. You've got a hearing aid right here.
We do.
We've got a mobile phone right there.
We do.
What's going to happen?
What we're going to do is we actually have a mobile phone here hooked up to what we call a base station simulator. So this simulates what a cell phone tower would do. So this would be just like you would have if you were on a call. And we're just going to put this particular hearing aid close to the phone.
My worst sound. That's a radio person's nightmare, I have to tell you. So there's an obvious interference, and imagine having that actually right inside your head, effectively.
Right, that's exactly right. And that sound's going to go right into someone's ear canal. And so they're going to be hearing that noise, and then in combination with anybody speaking to them over the phone. Probably, I guess, 10 years ago or so, that wouldn't be so uncommon. Sometimes people obviously couldn't even communicate when they heard that. You can imagine how tiring it would be to listen to something like that. But over the years, what's happened is hearing devices have become more immune.
In large part because of the work of research audiologists like Linda Kosma-Spytek and her colleagues at Gallaudet University.
I'm Steve Joelstrom, and I'm an engineering consultant with this project. Before I got involved with this, I designed quite a bit of audio equipment, and my main experience with RF at that time was how to keep it out of my stuff.
RF being radio frequencies.
Yes, exactly. You would think that it wouldn't be a problem because it's a totally different part of the electromagnetic spectrum than we're dealing with audio. But in fact, things inside the hearing aid, for example, can act as miniature antennas, picking up the sound, and miniature, well, use an engineering term, detectors, which would be things that actually convert that radio frequency energy into audio frequencies. The primary aspect of work that's been done in this within the hearing aid industry is to make the transducers themselves. By transducers, we mean things that are meant to convert between the sound coming in and the and into electrical signals that can be worked on. And there were internal changes in the microphone that had to occur inside the microphone to filter out the radio frequency energy to prevent the problem from occurring right there. Beyond that, similar techniques had to be done in other parts of the hearing aid. And also, even though the conversion of the cell phone industry from analog to digital basically created our problems, that's also been a help with the hearing aids as they become more digital, because once the signal is digitized, then it is essentially immune from the radio frequency interference. So with these combined efforts really of various suppliers for the hearing aid industry and the manufacturers themselves within the hearing aid industry, the immunity of them has improved by leaps and bounds, to the extent that many hearing aids right now are virtually immune to most any sort of problem that a cell phone can generate.
There's certainly an incentive for hearing aid manufacturers to improve things. Is there an incentive for mobile telephony manufacturers to improve things?
There is a regulatory incentive now. For many years, the FCC attempted to allow some sort of voluntary compliance to occur, but they really needed to step in, and they did so in 2003. Actually, it was a large consumer effort saying we haven't been able to have this work out in a voluntary way. We need some regulation. You know, we always want someone with hearing loss and who's a hearing device wearer not to have to think about accessibility, that it's just something that is universally available, universally designed into a product. Landline phones actually are that way. There's a slightly different meaning for hearing aid compatibility for those, but as of 2000, about
100% compatibility for landline. We'd love to see that. I'm not sure that that will actually happen. There are technical issues that may not permit that to occur, but I'd love to see the number as high as possible.
Linda Cosmas-Bitek. We've heard about TTY or teletypewriter technologies, but then the internet arrived and video phones also came onto the scene, and we're now living in the era of the visual. Great for people who are deaf, like engineer Norman Williams.
I'd say probably in 1995, deaf people started playing with video chat programs on the computer. And for the first time, deaf people could see one another over the internet. And since then, many new products have come on the scene. And the FCC is the United States Federal Communications Commission, has recognized that video should also be provided through the video relay service because it's a form of access. When deaf people sign to one another, they sign approximately 200 words per minute, and it's very much similar to the way hearing people talk to one another. But people who are very good at typing type approximately 60 words per minute. And also with the TTY, two deaf people couldn't interrupt one another. It's one-way communication. And so one person types and then the other person takes their turn. But through the video phone, two people can talk to one another in a more normal fashion because they can interrupt one another. And lately, more video phones have come on the scene that have been designed particularly for deaf individuals. And so it's been amazing.
So we're looking at a... Oh, there we are. Actually, we're looking at the unit and we're looking back at ourselves. So there's a video of us on the screen. There's a camera.
And so basically a deaf person makes a phone call to the video relay service, and it's free for the deaf user. The operator is there at a call center, and they'll place the phone call to the desired party who that deaf person wants to call, and they're able to have a phone conversation through an intermediary.
What difference has internet telephony made? Also, the iPhone. I mean, smartphones have transformed the way we can communicate now. So in some sense, that old technology of TTY, is it redundant?
So manufacturers who are making phones haven't allowed video calls until relatively recently with the iPhone, for example, that you mentioned. Just allowed that last summer with FaceTime. And deaf people love that. But now it's limited to just using Wi-Fi. There are now mobile video phone calls that are being made possible over the 3G network. And so deaf people are starting to use that. But I don't think that they're reliable enough in order for deaf people to give up their home video phones.
I guess I'm surprised that these have only come online in the last 5 years. But I'm also surprised that there are so many different pieces of equipment on the market.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you can't just buy an off-the-shelf product and use it for the VRS service. You need to have special software modifications. If it's possible, it's nice to have a flashing light in order to indicate someone's calling. It needs to really be designed for the deaf consumer to call other deaf consumers and to call the VRS operators.
With portable telephony, I mean, you need to use your hands. So if you're portable, you need to be able to prop it up somewhere, or, I mean, otherwise you're juggling it on your lap, or...
Well, last week I just bought a special case that had a stand built into it. I can also sign one-handed. And before all this technology came about, I thought that would be much more difficult than it is, but it really isn't a problem. It's a little bit more of an effort to understand than two-handed signing, but the communication happens just fine.
Norman, thank you very much.
In fact, I have a grandchild who's deaf, and she has cochlear implants. It's wonderful that she's able to hear speech and she's able to produce speech, but she also signs, because signing is a very important part of her identity. Her parents feel that way, that it's a very important part of our identity. And also, batteries die, and
yeah,
people take showers
That's
and sleep. And so having this additional language, which is a visual language, is very valuable.
It's something that strikes me about the staff who aren't deaf at Gallaudet. Many developed a formative relationship with the deaf community early in their lives, and Matthew Backey is no exception. It certainly changes the way he works as an audiologist.
Yeah, I'm Matthew Backey. I'm the chair of the Hearing Speech Language Sciences Department at Gallaudet University. I have a deaf brother, and he went to a school for the deaf. It was an oral program in those days, and they weren't given any opportunity to learn sign language or anything like that. And he didn't do very well. So as he got older, I began to learn sign language with him. We were great pals and spent a lot of time together and I was very curious about his hearing. It got me involved in teaching the deaf. After my service in the military, I entered a program for deaf education, and the rest is history. I've been teaching. After 12 years, I went into audiology.
As we've heard, adapting to new communications technologies takes work. But some people are left to fly alone. Take the cochlear implant, for example.
Typically in the United States, when a person is given a cochlear implant, they're advised to listen to books on tape and listen to people, and it's all very informal. Many people believe that just by using your cochlear implant in your daily life, that you will naturally acquire these skills.
Which makes the trial being run by Matthew Backey and colleagues something of a revolution, starting with first-time cochlear implant users.
Cochlear implant provides sound, but that sound is very different from the sound you would get from a hearing ear. It's an artificial sound, and so people need to adapt to that. They need to learn to use the cues that are inherent in that signal, and so we need to give them a lot of practice in using that sound. So that's a kind of a speech perception aspect to oral rehabilitation. The practice of listening and understanding what's being said, in that we use a paradigm in which a story is read to a person and then they repeat back that story line by line. And if they don't understand it, then they use strategies to try to get the information that's there. And over time, the rate at which they're able to track a story increases. We've shown in some of our research that when you use this tracking method over a period of 8 weeks, you get significant improvements in speech understanding through the cochlear implant.
What's the clinical trial looking into then?
Well, we've developed a 6-week program that incorporates speech perception training, some counseling, and the use of the technology, the hands-on, how to change the batteries and so forth, as well as communication strategies. So there's a very systematic 6-week program that we're evaluating. The idea here is that if we can show that somebody who takes this 6-week course and maybe 3 months down the road has better speech understanding and better outcomes on a quality of life measure, then that would indicate it's worthwhile providing this kind of program to people. We need hard evidence to do that because often people are depending on third-party payments. And without good research evidence to show that the treatment that you're providing gives good results, you're not going to get that third-party payment.
And evidence is what Associate Professor Matthew Backey is gathering in a randomised controlled trial currently underway. Just a taste in this week's show, more details on our website. And it was interesting to hear that deaf students are also training to be audiologists here at Gallaudet, a shift for the profession, no doubt. Another scientist bringing his experience of being deaf to his own compelling research is geneticist Dr. Derek Braun. It turns out that a gene mutation known to contribute to deafness could bestow surprising benefits. The beautiful paradox of biology at work. The culprit is called Connection 26. It sits on our 13th chromosome and it accounts for a large proportion of cases of congenital deafness.
In the United States, and in the Midwest, we'd say actually it's around 50%. In terms of Asia, research tends to suggest that that number's much higher. You have to be mindful that there are other 100 other genes that have been identified as causing deafness because of certain mutations, and then really considering those that are also suspected of being causes of deafness, then we're talking around 200 to 300 different genes, most of those being very low incidence in nature.
Why would it be biologically plausible for a mutation on the Connection 26 gene to contribute to deafness? And I also understand that it plays a role in skin disorders as well, so there's a combined story here.
Connection 26 is found throughout the body. We haven't identified every single possible area within the body. However, within the cochlea, that's the area that's responsible for being sure that the potassium concentration is consistent and not disrupted. Otherwise, the functions in the ear won't actually work well.
Now, potassium concentration is important for cells to communicate, isn't it?
Yes, and it's important for sound transduction.
Conversion of sound
as a vibration to an electrical signal.
Exactly.
Now, it's intriguing to me that a mutation that might cause congenital deafness might confer an advantage, an evolutionary advantage. Can you explain the investigation that you're undertaking?
My research is tied to studies of selective suppression of genes and chromosomes. Now, there are two things that have been shown so far. One is the showing that connection 26 mutations can also have an effect on skin thickness. If a tissue culture is taken from that skin, it grows faster and thicker, and that's of interest. We suspect that there may be a connection there to resistance to infection. And then secondly, the point I'm actually favoring is that we have one group that has shown that for dysentery, the infection of dysentery within the intestines actually requires connection 26, and with the removal of connection 26, we don't see that infection in the tissue culture. Now, of course, this hasn't been studied in adult humans, but it does seem very promising.
So the gene might have protected people against dysentery and other infections.
Exactly.
Was this a gene that you think conferred this benefit to deaf people particularly, or was this before it caused a deafness? Was it sort of optimum at a time in history before it caused deafness?
We don't know yet. Now, I suspect that it gives the most benefit to its carriers, but we haven't seen studies in that yet. That's what I'd like to do. In terms of the number of carriers, about 3% of people are carriers. You actually have to have two copies of the gene to become deaf. If you carry a single copy, then you won't be deaf. You will have normal hearing and will appear normal, but you may, in fact, have increased resistance to disease. Now, most deaf children actually come from hearing parents, and that's because both parents may be carriers but be unaware that they carry that and then pass it on to their children.
How do you feel about doing this work as someone who is deaf? I gather that there's quite a lot of discussion, heated discussion, about finding out the genetic basis of deafness, heated discussion amongst the deaf community, because there's a concern that at some stage you might then undertake gene therapy to eliminate that mutation and so eliminate deafness.
I have no ambivalence about my research. In fact, the deaf people that are involved in this research are thrilled to be involved. And it is not our goal to eradicate deafness. It's not our role to characterize deafness as a disabled group with less rights, anything of the sort. We're actually just looking at human evolutionary history and at how deaf people have important roles within that. And this, in fact, has instilled a great deal of pride in the deaf community. I see that certainly in terms of the students that work in this lab and are very proud to be involved in the research.
If this gene does confer a benefit, what sort of message does that send to the deaf community and the wider community about the nature and origins of deafness?
Well, it will be the first time that I can think of that deaf researchers have taken upon themselves to research deafness in this way, in terms of genetics research, and found something of value. I think it will be very significant for the anthropological genetics community. And I think this also encourages us not to look at deaf people as patients or inferiors that need our assistance. We are all, in fact, human, and we are all equal. We don't buy our genes. That's simply the luck of the draw.
Dr. Derek Braun speaking to me through interpreter Adam Bartley. Striking research, isn't it? And that's a wrap on the Gallaudet University Experience. All the transcripts of this series on deaf culture, education and science on the All in the Mind website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, along with a place for your conversation. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks also to Corin Podger. Over the next few shows, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and guests join me on the stage from the 2011 Happiness and Its Causes Conference.
On Rear Vision, we ask,
when will I be famous?
And when did celebrity begin to outrank fame and change the face and practices of journalism?
Phone phone hacking is wrong. Phone hacking is illegal.
What role then for the public and consumers?
We've become simultaneous voyeurs and participants in celebrity culture.
A history of muckraking, gossip, privacy and headlines on Rear Vision. Download or stream it from the Radio National website.